This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Basic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in studio with you, along with my producer, Lee Della Pina. And each and every week on this program, we have the privilege to talk with so many of the people that make this game go. And of course, I'm talking about the trainers in our sport. And we get to hear not just about some of the outstanding horses they've been around, but certainly about their lives and their backgrounds and how they became interested in horse racing. So many of those stories are the same, and so many have some differences that make them very, very unique. And tonight, no exception. We're going to begin with trainer Steve Margolis here in just a moment, but want to remind you that if you miss any portion of these shows any week, you can go back to our website, listen to a podcast at horseracingradio.net. And of course, you can always listen on iTunes at your leisure. All there, horseracingradio.net and on iTunes. Steve Margolis has saddled 522 career winners to date. He is closing in on $19 million in purse earnings. Those 522 winners include the 2003 Breeders' Cup Sprint Champion Cajun Beat. And I now welcome trainer Steve Margolis to Trainer Talk here tonight. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. Looking forward to hearing your story, growing up in New York City, at least being born in New York. I'm going to assume that the New York tracks are what first hooked you on racing.
Yeah, I was when I was going to school, actually, I worked one summer at Monmouth Park before I went to Belmont. Just kind of had a connection there, and it was down by the water, and just kind of walked horses one summer. I think it was about the summer of 83. It's kind of a while back now, but we just kind of did it one summer, and I kind of did it more as a novelty, just kind of thought it was kind of a fun thing to do. And then as I did it more, I kind of thought it was very interesting and very exciting.
Go back to even before you got to the racetrack. As a kid growing up, what was your first exposure to the sport?
It's funny, you know, growing up, I mean, you know, you'd see it on television here and there, like the old Frank Wright show, I forget what channel was on, and that was kind of interesting. But I really wasn't exposed at a young age to it, you know, growing up in the city and all. Moved out to Long Island during high school, but just kind of like later during my last couple of years of high school is when I kind of met someone that kind of can't recall the exact connection, but you know, someone down in Monmouth Park, and just kind of went down there and worked during the summer once.
Were your parents or any other family members involved in the sport in any way?
No, have no connection of any cousins or relatives or anything in horse racing at all. No, I've always liked sports, but you know, horse racing was definitely, you know, nothing that I really even had any connection with.
What did they think when you told them you were gonna maybe take your hand or try your hand at training racehorses?
Yeah, I mean, as I started, you know, doing it more, you know, walking and grooming, and I did start on the bottom and kind of worked my way up, and they thought, well, you know, if you don't want to go to college and if you want to, you know, just, you know, do what you want to make you happy, and just, you know, they didn't put pressure on me to do it or not to do it, and I just kind of, like I said, more in the beginning, I kind of did it more as a novelty, and then as I was doing it more, it was more exciting, and I kind of thought, hey, this might be fun to try and work my way up and see if I could do this.
Really? So you had pretty cool parents then, that they didn't, you know, make a fuss about you not going to college and let you hang out around the racetrack.
Yeah, they just, you know, figured, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, some families, if you push your kids and they regret what they did, and then in the long run, it'd be better off, you know?
So when you were in high school, obviously this is when you first started to kind of get a feel for the racetrack and being around it a little bit. Were you doing other things, or did you have other goals outside of horse racing that maybe you were shooting for at that time?
Well, not really. It just kind of was kind of figure out what to do, and I didn't really have focus on anything in particular. Just kind of thought this was, you know, intriguing, and like I said, as I started doing it more, then it became kind of more, I thought it would be something to, you know, pursue.
What kind of student were you? Straight A's?
I'm kind of B, you know. I wasn't a great, you know, perfect student by any means, but, trying to figure out what you want to do. Sometimes when you're young, sometimes some people it comes quicker than others, and for me, I just kind of really didn't know, you know.
So tell me about your first job on the racetrack. How did this come about?
He said, I forget who it was, but I worked for someone one summer in Monmouth. Shoot, I can't even remember. Man, it's going way back. But the first job that I can, I worked for John Veach. That was pretty much my first job. It was, I believe it was the winter of 85, and it was at Hialeah. And I was just walking horses. He had some good horses back then, Proud Truth, and that was before Hialeah closed, when it was still kind of, you know, the Flamingo and those races were over there. So I just kind of walked for horses for him for a while, and we went up to Belmont, and I got an opportunity to be a groom. I worked for John for about a year, then went to work for Pat Bird, who we're still friends to this day. Was a groom and then became a foreman and assistant. I stayed with Pat for 3 years. Went to work for Howard Tesher, who was like a dad to me from 89 to 96. And I was pretty much New York and Florida. And I, you know, worked my way up with him and became a foreman and assistant trainer. And then Stan Huff was my last job from 97 to 2000. Where I was his assistant between New York and then the Kentucky string, and then I started on my own in the fall of 2000.
That's an amazing quartet of trainers to learn from as you were coming up. Go back to John Veach for just a minute. He really did have it rolling in the 70s with all the Calumet-owned horses. He had R. Mims and Allie Dar and Devona Dale.
You come
there in the mid-80s.
Yeah, that was before my time,
What was it like when you walked into his barn for the first time, and why John Veach?
You know, again, I sometimes you can't recall all these things, but I kind of knew someone that was over there. I forget it somehow, and he needed someone. And, you know, back in that day, he had the private job with Darby Dan, and it was hard to get a job over there as a hot walker or a groom because, you know, people have like 2 days off a week. And I think back then his primary owner might have been Galbraith, and they paid the insurance for people, so it was a real coveted job. Even as a groom, he had the grooms that worked for him when I was there that rubbed Alidar. I think a gentleman by the name of Clyde, I forget his last name. So he had like these people that stayed with him for years, and I had an opportunity to start, you know, walking. And then, but no, it was a very proper run outfit. You know, back in that day, I mean, he had all the, you know, private, these good horses and Darby Creek Roads and His Majesty, these pedigrees you don't see anymore, and, you know, the top-notch people working for him, and it was exciting. I was very young at the time, but I was kind of real, you know, you were kind of very enthused about it all, you know?
Yeah, what were some of the things you learned in getting started with a guy like John Veach?
Well, with John, I was pretty much, like you said, I walked for a little bit and then became a groom, and everything was very regimented. I mean, he had, like, you know, top-notch people, excessive, a lot of people there to do everything. Kind of more like organization. You know, and I was young back then, too, but, you know, I wasn't, say, 100% focused, you know, like I was when I went to work for Howie or whatever. But, you know, you could see the way he did things was very regimented. He had, like, top-notch people. It was very organized. As far as the horse care part, you know, I was still green, you know, learning like a novice myself. So I didn't really, I just was a groom, and I just kind of, you know, learned the basics of the grooming, and, you know, as I was working for him that year, and then as I went on to Pat Byrne and the other guys, then I, of course, was learning more and just picking it all up as we went on.
Yeah, tell me about working with Pat. That had to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, I started with Pat in Belmont. It was about 87, and, you know, I was a groom, and then became a foreman, and, you know, Pat and his wife at the time, Jill, they were, you know, training a few years, and he had a private stable called Petey Lane Stables. It, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. It was out of Ocala. And he had a kind of a private job for them, and he had a split division between Belmont and Atlantic City at the time was still running. And I spent a little summer down there, and Pat gave me my shot. I had my first assistant trainer's license with him. I think it was in probably 87 or 88. And so I've known Pat a long time. We still see each other now that he's at Churchill also. But no, it was good. You know, just kind of, you know, when you're young and you're trying to soak everything in and learn. And I was excited about the opportunity to hopefully, you know, get to be a trainer someday.
Did he have a different style than what you experienced when you were working with John?
Well, like I said, with John, I wasn't really focusing as much on the training part there because I was only like a year or two from, you know, just starting, and, you know, it's just so much to take in, and it was a different type of outfit. I mean, you know, John's was very regimented and very, you know, he had a private job at the big league, and we were at Belmont Park with all the, you know, he had the first class operation, and, you know, Pat's job was still good. It was just different, and I was learning more and wanting to do more. So as far as me, I kind of, as I went to work for Pat, I did more and I started learning more.
And then you said you went to work for Howie Tesher, and you described him as kind of a father figure to you. How come?
Well, he was just a great guy. Howie has just a great feel for people. He's just a very good person. He was a sharp trainer. He had trained a lot of good horses when I was working for him. But he had a way about him with people. He was just very easy to talk with, and, you know, he had great relationships with his owners because they would socialize and always come to the barn. And as I worked for him from 89 to 96, I was a foreman and then became an assistant. And, you know, he was a great, you know, as I was growing up and starting to learn, and, you know, he always had good advice and, you know, a lot of knowledge, of course, in life just from living all the things he lived and with racing and life in general. But and actually Pat had worked for him. Pat Byrne worked for Howie before I worked for Pat. So it's funny how we kind of, everything came full circle. But Howie was great to work for. You know, I learned a lot and was on my own in New York, and spent a few winters at Belmont as we were running at Aqueduct. And that was a great experience. And, you know, as you work for different people, yeah, like you said, you learn different things and see how they do it, and, you know, you try to put together, you know, a whole kind of system how you want to do things, you know?
Yeah, who would you say you most closely resemble in terms of your philosophy in training horses and the way you treat your clients? Would it be Howie Tesher?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I worked for Stan Huff was my last job, and I would say probably, although I did a lot at Howie's and I was on my own, when I worked for Stan Huff from 97 to 2000, I was really on my own. He kind of left me alone, and he was in Belmont. I was in Kentucky. And at that stage, you know, from 97 to 2000, I mean, he gave me a lot of reins. Stan was very busy. He had a lot of horses for Country Roberts, Robert Roberts back then. And so I kind of did more at Stan's entering and really just the training aspect, even though me and Stan would talk because they were his horses. But, you know, I think a little bit of both. I mean, Howie, you know, I learned a lot. And Stan, you know, you learn different things. And, you know, every person had their own thing that you kind of, you know, you liked or you kind of thought was good. And, you know, they both were very good horsemen. And, you know, Stan was like a father figure to me, too. He treated me really well, him and his wife. Cinda, before she passed, but they were both very good to me, and you know, gave me a lot of experience before I went on my own.
Talking with trainer Steve Margolis on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Steve, was there a specific moment when you just knew, hey, this is what I want to do for a living?
Yeah, I mean, as I was working for Howie, of course, you know, from the 89 to, you know, you figure, you know, if you're going to put this much time into it, it was exciting. I thought if I just kept working at it, I really, really wanted to do this. And then, of course, when I worked for Stan, you know, in 2000, then, you know, I was just kind of waiting. I was kind of biding my time. I, you know, didn't really have anyone calling me per se, but I knew I was ready to do it. And then I got a break when Stanley was training for this Robert and B. Roberts, who were very good to me also. Stan's wife, unfortunately, had gotten sick, and eventually she passed away, which was very sad. But I was, you know, I was ready to go on my own, but I wasn't rushing it. And I certainly didn't want to just, you know, kind of quit Stan because it was a very good job. But when he took a leave of absence, he left me a few of the horses. And Mr. Roberts had some stuff he was sorting out and had to sell some of them. But as it turned out, I started in the fall with three horses at Churchill.
Wow. How do you know when you're ready to make that break and go out on your own? It has to be a bit nerve-wracking, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, I mean, even if you start with just a few horses, I mean, you gotta have a little bit of a business plan. I mean, not that I was a business major, but you gotta have some money behind you. You gotta have, you know, things set up with your work comp and all your equipment to start with. Thankfully, Stan left me some of the equipment. He was very good to me. He had a lot of equipment, you know, barn stuff to use, and actually gave me some until I could get my own. But it's, you know, you got to have a little bit of a plan, and you know when you start out to try to, you know, make it work. You know how much, you know, you're going to need to get started, and you know, because you don't want to fail. Hopefully, you can, you know, keep going.
Well, you get your first victory in September of 2000 at Turfway Park. Describe that day. Look back on that day for a minute. Had to be pretty cool.
Yeah, that was exciting. It was for Mr. Roberts and his wife B, and I think her name was Ranker Alexis. I remember that, Willie Martinez. No, I mean, at the time, we just had like three or four horses, and, you know, we were at Churchill, and we went to Turfway, and no, it was great. I mean, you know, when you work for someone, even like a great guy like Pat or Stan or Howie, I mean, you know, there's nothing like doing it on your own. And, you know, all trainers have egos, of course. Of course, we all want to, you know, you want to have them in your name, and, you know, along with that becomes the, you know, responsibility of, you know, good and bad. But no, it was a great feeling when that filly won, and, you know, just real rewarding for me and the guys that worked for me at the time. We only had a couple people working for me, and I was doing some stuff my own too.
Hey, you know, you've mentioned learning from the ground up a couple of times here, Steve. Is it more rewarding for you, or maybe even an advantage for you over some trainers, because you have learned the business right from the very foundation all the way up?
I mean, I think partly. I mean, of course, nowadays they have these schools and, you know, they have these racing programs. But, you know, I mean, there's nothing like starting on the bottom in any company. I mean, when you walk horses and you kind of know what it's like, and especially as I got older, and, you know, you're working and you have a business now, you appreciate, I always appreciate all the people that work for me, because I know the job as a groom and a hot walker, you know, it's a very, you know, it's just a hard job. And for me to do it, you know, for a period of time, I appreciate and respect the people that work for me now. But it was good to do, because you kind of, you know, for doing it, you have the feel for the horse. I never galloped. That was one thing I never did was exercise. But I think grooming and, you know, knowing the legs and feeling all that and just working with the horse to understand that part of it was good for me, you know, since I didn't grow up in the business having a father or another relative that was a trainer.
How'd you celebrate after your first win?
I mean, I don't think we did much celebrating. It was, you know, winter time at Turfway, or, you know, fall or whatever it was. But, you know, we had a small stable, like four or five horses, and, you know, we were just thrilled. And I might have, you know, went out and had a beer and some dinner. But, you keep kind of working and just keep moving forward.
Just one beer. I'm very disappointed, Steve.
I don't know. I can't remember. Maybe I had a couple. I'm out of.
Oh, that was a good night then.
Anyway.
That was a good celebration then.
Yeah.
Steve Margolis here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazit Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Let's talk about your Breeders' Cup sprint winner, Cajun Beat, and how magical that had to be for you. He wins the sprint in 2003, but tell me a little bit about Cajun Beat and that experience of having him in your barn.
Now, that was exciting. I mean, I had some horses for Joe and John Hurricane, who we still have a horse here and there. They're from Owensboro. And Satish Sanan, the Padua Stables, they had this horse with Cam Gambolotti, who did well with them. And I just kind of was lucky. The horse had run bad, and they wanted to leave the horse at Churchill for the summer, and he had run bad in the Matt Wynn, I think the Muddy Track or whatever the case was. And I had a couple, you know, lower-level claiming horses with Joe and John, and they said, "Ah, Steve, we got this horse, and, you know, Cam's going to go back to Calder, and Satish owns half of him with us. You know, I think we're going to let him stay with you and see if we can build him back up." Or, you know, because he had already won a couple stakes with Cam, but, you know, he certainly, you know, threw it a clunker when they left him here. But, no, it was fun because we got the horse, and, like you said, you know, no thing on Cam. He just ran bad, and they just wanted to kind of leave us so they could watch him run. And we, you know, he came out of it a little beat up, but nothing negative on anyone's part. He just was. They didn't like the mud that day, and then we got to run him, I think, once at Churchill, and he ran a big second on the turf. He was it was in like an allowance race, and then we decided, talking with John and Satish, and that we were going to try the Summit of Speed, and he ran a big second, I believe, in the, I think the race was called the Carryback.
Okay.
Was that the race for three-year-olds, I think?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And then it was a bit of a price, but the horse ran a big race. And after he ran that race, we kind of knew that the horse was starting to get good again. And I was training him between Churchill and Ellis, because I was stabled at Ellis that summer, you know. And we took him up to Turfway, and I believe his next race was the Kentucky Sprint. And Cornelio Vlasis rode him, and he ran a heck of a race that day. I believe he ran 9 and change, or you could tell me, I don't. And he beat that horse from Dallas as Clock Stopper.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So, no, the horse really, really got good after that. And it was funny, and I'll say this day. I remember after the horse won, you know, we really didn't have a plan right away, but Satish, who I see frequently here and there, he said, "Steve," he said, "I know he's a 3-year-old. Let's not be afraid. If you think he's doing good, I want to take a shot in the Breeders' Cup." And I even said to Joe and John, because I didn't know at the time, you know, where were we going to go with the horse. I was thinking, I think there was a race in the fall at Keeneland called the Perryville. It doesn't exist anymore for 3-year-olds. But I remember Satish telling me, "If this horse is doing good, I want to take a shot at the Breeders' Cup." So he kind of was the one that kind of, you know, wanted to take the shot, and then the rest was history, yeah.
Could you ever imagine that just a few years after going out on your own, you'd be winning a Breeders' Cup sprint with a horse like Cajun Beat?
No, I know. It's funny because, you know, with horses, it's all timing. And, you know, for us, we were fortunate to get the opportunity with the horse. And, you know, he ran in the Carryback, and then he won the Turf race, he just really got good. And, you know, timing with these horses isn't very important. And, you know, in the fall of the year, the horse got really good, and he was very happy with himself. And, you know, that Breeders' Cup was a huge race for the horse. He was peaking at the right time.
Well, right before Cajun Beat started hitting his best stride in 2003, you had another milestone moment in your career when you actually started a horse in what most people would say is the greatest race we have in the game, the Kentucky Derby in 2002 with Request for Parole. Tell me about that experience.
Oh, yeah. But that horse was very exciting. I had him as a 2-year-old, and, you know, he was a homebred that, you know, Robert B. Roberts bred by Judge T.C., and out of an unraced mare, and he was a neat little horse. We had a lot of luck with him. He won, you know, a stake at Ellis. He just got beat to Harlan Tolley in the Cradle. You know, we won some stakes up at Turfway, and he was an overachiever. That horse, he was. That was very exciting to take a horse a broke his maiden at Ellis Park, and the next year to be in the Derby.
Yeah, what was that experience like, Derby Week, just being part of that?
Oh, yeah, like you said, just to be on my own for a few years. And, you know, there's so many trainers in this game that do it forever, and you never get the opportunity just for one reason or another. And that was very exciting. I mean, I was, you know, younger and you know, kind of inexperienced as far as, you know, training for a long period of time. And, you know, it was exciting. And the horse came in fifth place. And to be honest, I thought that was a big victory as far as for what the horse was and what he overcame, just to make it in the gate for the Derby.
You know, I've always been curious, Steve. You mentioned different riders' names, Cornelio Velasquez, Willie Martinez. I know Ramon Dominguez was aboard Cajun Beat in the Breeders' Cup for you.
Actually, Cornelio won the Breeders' Cup for me, but I think Ramon might have rode the horse later on after I didn't have him because Bobby Franco had got him.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
Do trainers have go-to riders that they'll use, you know, for when they have a big race like that?
Oh, I think so, for sure. I mean, you know, when I used to be on a different circuit, of course, wherever you go, you kind of try to build relationships with these riders, especially in the bigger races, you know, which is more important. Back then, you know, I was on a little bit of a different circuit, but Cornelio did very good on the horse, and then we actually had to take him off because Satish wanted Jerry Bailey to ride him over in Dubai, but that was another story. But for sure. I mean, you know, now that I'm on my own and I have my stable built up, I have a couple of guys that I like. Sean Bridgmahan is, you know, one of my go-to guys now, and Brian Hernandez, Corey Lannery. You know, sometimes you can't always get the exact rider you want just in everyday races, but when it comes to these better horses, like in the stakes and stuff like that, you like to try to, you know, keep it with a jockey that knows the horse and is comfortable with him.
Steve, I always like to wrap up these interviews by asking our guests what it is they like to do outside of horse racing when you actually get a few minutes away from the racetrack or a week that you can take a vacation. And I know that's very rare. What else does Steve Margolis like to do?
Well, I tell you what, it's funny. Me and my wife, Sue, we spend 4 months in New Orleans in the winter, which is great. We have a lot of local friends down there, and we really have a good time. You know, I go fishing. Actually, I do more in New Orleans in the winter than we do in Louisville. I don't know. It just seems like there's, you know, I go to some football games, some basketball, and then I have my friend Buddy Wall. We go fishing, Chick-fil-A. I mean, I just have a lot of entertainment more in the winter when we're in New Orleans. But here, I don't know. I mean, if I can, I don't own a boat, but I like going on a boat and when I get an opportunity. And I'm not a golfer, but I just enjoy my downtime, you know, riding a bicycle and just relaxing, you know, watching sports and stuff like that is always good for me.
Big New Orleans Saints fan?
Yeah, big Saints fan. I mean, I'm not a Giants fan at heart because I grew up, but I root for the Saints now because we spend 4 months and then we enjoy the Pelicans and the basketball too now. So it's fun. It's a great city to spend 4 months in.
Steve, been a really enjoyable visit here tonight. Can't thank you enough for taking the time. Always great to catch up with you and to hear your story. Just amazing. I appreciate it. All the best moving forward. And thanks for being here, my friend.
Okay, Mike, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, trainer Steve Margolis, like all of our guests who appear on Trainer Talk, going to receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get that out to him right away. Fun visit. Second half still ahead. Stay tuned. Do not go anywhere. It's Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasic Tipton. Where will you be this summer? The Fasic Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The
sales $295,000 average in 2013, maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer? Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair Strip's gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair Strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair Strips. DerbyBox.com is the world's only full-time tour and travel company devoted predominantly to thoroughbred racing and the Kentucky Derby. A local Louisville area business since 1998, DerbyBox.com offers more than 25 years first-hand experience in Kentucky Derby travel and ticket packages. At DerbyBox.com, you'll find tickets and packages for every budget and taste, from Millionaire's Row to the infield. So don't delay. Book your trip to the 2014 Kentucky Derby today at DerbyBox.com. DerbyBox.com is an affiliated with Churchill Downs or Ticketmaster.
It's been more than a decade since Funnyside became the first New York bred to win the Kentucky Derby. Now, New York has two combatants hoping to follow in Funnyside's hoofsteps.
It's Samrat narrowly, and Samrat will stay undefeated.
So New York bred Samrat and his brave runner-up in both the Gotham and Wither Stakes, Uncle Cy, are both on the road to the Derby while proving that New York breeders are increasingly breeding quality thoroughbreds that can compete across America and around the world. Learn more about our awards program at nybreds.com.
The Kentucky Derby runs here.
Jarvis War is absolutely flying. It's had his golden soul, but it is Orb to win the Derby.
The 140th Kentucky Derby, May 3rd, exclusively on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to the second half of Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Penna in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Fun visit in the first half of the program with trainer Steve Margolis, and now looking ahead to the second half here with trainer Brendan Walsh, who, unlike Steve, a bit of a different scenario here. Just getting started with his training career. He is a native of Cork, Ireland. Brendan has saddled just 14 winners in his brief career, but he's coming off his best year so far with 10 winners in 2013, and he is nice enough to be with me here now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Brendan, thanks for taking the time.
No problem at all, Mike. Thank you.
Yeah, a bit of an opposite scenario from Steve in the first half of the program. He's been doing this a little bit longer than you, but you've had some pretty good success in just the couple of years you've been training on your own.
Yeah, things have been going pretty good, Mike, you know, when happy enough with a good year last year, which was great. And of course, we had Wordley in the Breeders' Cup as well, running third in the marathon. So that was fantastic to have that. So, you know, business is going pretty good. It's not easy, but, you know, I never thought that for a second that it would be. So, but no, we've got some nice horses for this year too, and they've been running pretty good down here in Florida, so we're looking forward to getting back up north now and getting back up home to Kentucky.
Well, you know, Brendan, there's so many Irishmen involved in the sport of racing. I know it's extremely popular in your native country. Talk about growing up in Ireland, and as a kid, how did you initially get started and get hooked on horse racing?
I was always, for some reason, Mike, I was always just crazy about horses, and I wanted to be a jockey for as long as I can remember. We had a farm at home. We didn't really have horses on it, but I was so, I just nagged my parents into buying me a pony, and we bought a pony, and that kind of taught me how to ride. And then I went to apprentice school in Ireland when I was 15, and I went from there. You know, just built it along from there. But yeah, just always from the get go, I was just totally obsessed with them. You could say, you know.
Were your other family members, were they involved in the sport at all?
Not really. I mean, you know, they had a general interest, as a lot of people do in Ireland. You know, I was. It's amazing, you know, you just talk to anybody in Ireland and they know what, you know, who Frankie Dettori is and who, you know, they all have somewhat of an interest in racing. It's funny, it's just a tradition over there. But, no, not directly involved, but there was a bunch of people around me too that had horses and that trained and bits and pieces. So, you know, there was always somewhere to learn something, you know.
Would your parents take you to the track or as a kid?
Yeah, we went a bit, Mike. You know, we went a bit, not all the time, but you know, we went a bit. My dad always, he used to have greyhounds as well, so we were kind of hooked up in that as well. But you know, we used to go racing a little bit. But I think when you're around animals, like we had a farm and that, and I think you just get a general feel for animals, and then. You know, naturally, when horses show up, you kind of, I don't know, it's just a thing that some Irish people seem to have. They just have a natural feel for horses, you know.
Your dad used to own greyhounds?
He did, yeah, still does, actually. I was back at home not so long ago, and he races them. He trains them on our farm at home and races them. You know, kind of now it's more of a hobby for him than anything. But, you know, it's interesting because he's always, you know, he tries to relate it to horse racing and he's always asking me about different things and trying to, you know, see what we're doing with horses and try and practice it with the dogs. But it's big business in Ireland, actually, the greyhounds. It's just a smaller scale to horses, you know.
Did you ever have any interest in training the greyhounds?
Not really, Mike. No, I mean, I did. I mean, I've went around and went racing with them when I was a kid for years and years. But you know, as a profession, it was only always going to be second to the horses. You know,
what's harder to train, greyhounds or horses?
I'd say horses are a lot. You know, you can put a greyhound in his kennel. So and forget about them when you're done with them, and they won't. They don't seem to come up with half the stuff that these horses do. You know, it's just so much more intense. But yeah, definitely, I'd go with the greyhounds than the horses. It must be a lot easier.
Well, you mentioned really wanting to be a jockey first and foremost, and you attended the jockey school in Ireland. What happened there?
I went there for a year, Mike, and I didn't like it.
Really?
I think, yeah, it was funny. I think basically I got homesick. You know, you go there when you're 15, so you're, you know, I don't know. I just didn't really, you know, I don't know. I guess I missed home more than anything. And I was caught up in some different sports in school as well. I did a lot of boxing, and I kind of missed that. And in the end, I just decided I'd go back to school. So I went back to school and finished school, actually. Finished high school, as you call it here. And I did then straight back into the horses again, of course. I went to the Irish National Stud. Well, I actually went to work for a horse vet first. And I was with him for 6 months. And then he got me into the stud management course in the Irish National Stud. So I did that, which was very prestigious at the time. And went through that, and then I basically traveled around, worked at Coolmore for a little while, went over to France for a little while, did some work there. But it could never get me away from the riding, Mike. There wasn't enough going on them stud farms. So eventually I went back to riding again, and I went to work for Sheikh Mohammed to their farm in Ireland, and they used to break all the yearlings there in the winters, and I'd spend the winters there, and then I'd go over to France to John Hammond, who was he still is a very, very good top trainer in France. and I do my summers with John and go back and forth, and I did that for a few years, and then they decided they wanted to send some horses to Dubai when we had them broke one spring, and I went over there with them, and I got, you know, obviously they were horses for Godolphin. And of course I went up to Alquaz, the main Godolphin outfit, because there was guys going on vacation, and I galloped horses for them, and Tommy Albertrani was up there at the time, and I kind of got acquainted with Tommy and a few others, and eventually a position opened up with them, a full-time position, and I went and worked for them for a long time. I did like nine winters in Dubai, Mike, which was great. And then we went back and forth. We'd go to Newmarket in England, and we'd come over to the States as well during the summers. And of course, we did a ton of traveling. You know, I went to Hong Kong a bunch of times, Singapore, Japan. I went all over the world with them. So it was a great experience.
Talking with trainer Brendan Walsh here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Yeah, you were definitely racking up the frequent flyer miles at that time, Brendan. And that had to be an amazing experience as a young man to be able to go to Dubai and go to the different places around the world and experience what racing's like in each of those. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, and that was back in the day. Like, you know, Godolphin at the time had maybe 55, 60 horses, and they were basically the worst horse in the barn was like a listed / grade 3 horse. You know, I mean, Dubai Millennium was there, Street Cry was there, E-Dubai, Fantastic Light, Delami. I mean, they were just, and, you know, you just went out. Every time one of them ran, you expected it to win or at least go very close. But it was a fantastic experience. I mean, it was just to be around horses of that caliber. I remember being, like, overwhelmed when I went there first. You walked in the first morning and you were down to ride a horse that had just won a graded stake or what have you. And, you know, it was weird, but it was a great, great experience. I mean, I'm never going to be around that many horses of that class again, but it was a great experience, you know, and it prepared you for being around good horses down the line. Hopefully there's plenty of them to come. You know?
Yeah, you never know. Maybe you'll have your own barn full of grade one winners eventually.
I don't know if we'll ever have that quantity of them at one time. I mean, it was unreal. I think we broke a world record at the time. We had 19 group or grade one winners in one year. And then I think Bobby Frankel beat that. And then Aidan O'Brien, I think, beat it after that. So when you're competing against guys like that, it's great. And it's just fantastic experience. They were great. Just fantastic people to work for. You know, they took care of us all so well. And, you know, like I said, if they thought you were able, they sent you all over the world with horses. And that was, you know, it was a big responsibility, but it was what I wanted to do. So it was a fantastic experience.
What was your favorite place that you had the chance to visit?
I loved Hong Kong, actually. Mike is really nice. I was lucky enough to go there a few times. It's just like unbelievable. The only international day over there, the only atmosphere I've seen to beat it or to be on a par with it is Kentucky Derby Day. It's just like, I mean, they just come swarming off the trains there, and the noise is unbelievable, and the atmosphere. It's just, I mean, there's like 20 odd racing news papers, like publications over there. Like, you went out in the morning and all you could hear was click, 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 click with all these photographers. And, you know, they're just, it's like football here or soccer back home. You know, jockeys are like movie stars, horses are like movie stars. It's unbelievable. And they have a great system there. I mean, they're, you know, all their money, they have a tote system. All their money goes back into the racing. Well, not all, because a lot of it goes, you know, it goes back into, like, the government take it back, I guess, and they put it into hospitals, schools. You'll be passing schools and you'll say funded by the, you'll see on the signs funded by the Hong Kong Jockey Club. It's unbelievable what they do out there. But, you know, there's two tracks out there as well, which I guess that makes a big difference, and it's very restricted as to, like, you know, who owns horses, who trains horses, even the riders out there. You know, they only take the very, very best out there from all the countries all over the world.
When did you know that you wanted to be a trainer full time?
When I was in Godolphin, Mike, I really, you know, when I wasn't going to be a jockey, the natural next step was going to be to go training. And, you know, when I was in Godolphin, it was great in Godolphin, but it was, you know, I had to go out and learn in the real world too. You know, you there was so much money there. Money was never an object, you know, so it didn't really give you a great insight to what training was going to be like. So, you know, after I kind of did my time there, and you know, after spending so much time there, I felt it was time to go. And you know, one winter I was back there, and I thought, you know what, I've done as much as I'm going to do here. I'm going to make a change. And I went back to Newmarket that spring to work for a very good young trainer at the time, a guy called Mark Wallace, who was also and still is quite a close friend of mine. So Mark was he was building up his business at the time, and he was looking for an assistant. And he said, well, why don't you come here and help me out? So I said, yeah. I said, why not, you know? So I ended up going over and working for Mark.
And then you came here to the United States and worked for Eddie Keneally. But what led you to make the jump and come back here to the States?
I always liked American racing, Mike. It always had a bit of an attraction for me. And, you know, it's very hard to start training in Europe for somebody like me. You know, a lot of people, they're a trainer's son, or they're quite closely related to somebody. Ireland's literally impossible. I mean, Ireland, you've got four huge stables. Then you've got two or three that are kind of in the next level that are picking up their scraps. And then you've got 20 or 30 guys who really, you know, they really struggle, I think. I don't know how they do it, to be honest. In flat racing, anyway, the National Hunt, the steeplechasers are a little different. England, then, is kind of similar. The prize money there is not very good. And the outlay when you go to start up, it's huge. You know, you train on your own place, so you've got to go and rent a place, or you've got to rent a yard or a barn in Newmarket and try and train out of there. And you're on the back foot from the get-go. So I didn't think I was going to have a huge opportunity there. You know, America's different. And, you know, America, they tend to give you a bit more opportunity, I think. Even with horses that are not of the highest level, I think if you're smart with them, you can make them pay. And there's just more opportunity in general here. So I always kind of wanted to come back. I came over for a vacation because I've got a lot of friends here. I came over one fall. I was at Keeneland, and I met Eddie. And you know, I was got talking to him, and I told him what I've had in mind. And he said, well, if you want to come back at some stage, you know, I said, I might think about it in the spring. And he said, well, give me a call if you do. And I did. And you know, it just happened at the time his assistant was about to leave. And basically I did a month or 6 weeks with Eddie, and I went from just galloping to his assistant in no time. And you know, we got on great, and it was a fantastic experience. I mean, we hit it off from the get-go, and he was going through a phase where things were going really well, and his stable was starting to really build up. And we like I said, we hit it off and got on really well. And you know, I had a great time with Eddie. I mean, it was a great experience. I couldn't have went training on my own without that, Mike. You know, American racing so different to European, the training methods, the actual racing itself. So, I mean, to try and go training without any previous experience of being an assistant to somebody is virtually impossible. I mean, the whole system is totally different.
Yeah, well, Eddie's an outstanding horseman, and he's had an awful lot of success. What was it Brendan, that Eddie taught you, or some of the main things he taught you about American racing that really helped you as you started your own career?
You know, the nice thing, Mike, was rather than going to one of the big barns over here, you know, the big 200 horse barns that have five outfits all over the place, at the time, Eddie, he only had one barn. Basically, he went to Kentucky, he went to Saratoga for the meet, he came back to Kentucky, and then he came to Florida. Now he's got a couple of outfits, but, you know, so basically I had to get stuck into everything. And then when it expanded, he would go to Saratoga, or basically wherever he went, I went to the other place, you know, when he started to have a second string. So, I mean, you know, that to have nobody looking over your shoulder, and, you know, you were basically his eyes and ears. So that's a fantastic experience, which you don't get at home. You know, you don't get that experience at home. You've always got somebody watching you. So, you know, you were given a lot of responsibility. And, of course, I galloped a lot of Eddie's horses and worked a lot of Eddie's horses too, which, you know, so I had firsthand experience of pretty much everything, and I was able to know exactly what was going on in the barn. But, you know, and, you know, so you were stuck in everything. I mean, we did pretty much everything for him, Mike, you know, from the paychecks to the horses to the vets to, you know, you were stuck in everything. So for somebody that was going training, that was fantastic experience, you know.
You know, Brendan, I've had a lot of trainers tell me on this very same program that the first year or two that they started was really, really tough. And you mentioned going to the Breeders' Cup last year with Worldly. Talk to me about these first couple of years and what this has been like for you launching your own career.
It's so different here, Mike, in comparison to Europe. The first year, you know, dirt horses here, they have to be so ready when they start running, especially like the young horses when they come out first. They have to be so well educated, whereas in Europe, not so. Grass horses, you know, they got to learn how to leave the gate here on the dirts. You know, they've got to be out and gone, because if they miss a kick, they get stuck back in the kickback, and 9 out of 10 of them, you know, by the time they know what's hit them, they're out of the race. So horses just have to be so much more ready here, which Eddie taught me. But of course, when I went on my own, then I took a little bit more of a European approach. Oh, they were 75% ready. I'd bring them to the races and say, oh, well, the experience will do them good, and it did. It brought them on a ton. But of course, it being my first year, it started affecting my stats. Now, that's a thing in America. You know, you look at football, baseball, basketball. America's very much a country of stats, which Europe is starting to become, but not as much. So my stats in the first year were not that strong, because I was bringing horses, you know, kind of educating them before they reached their full potential. Albeit last year it paid off, because a few of them that I had in my first year, you know, had a pretty good grounding put into them, and it stood to them last year. My stats were a lot better, but yeah, I mean, the first year was tough, because, you know, like I said earlier on, it's different. I think no matter how long you work as an assistant for somebody, it's not like training yourself, because you have to deal with owners, you have to deal with, you know, the tracks, you know, the what's in the book for a horse. Like, I used to look at things that trainers that I worked for would do, and I'd say, oh, why is he doing that? Why is he doing that? I'd have no explanation. But, you know, you actually see then the circumstances they're under, be they under the influence of what's available to them for the track, or what an owner would prefer to do, or, you know, stuff like that. That's stuff that you never learn as an assistant. So you kind of have to come to grips with that, and you learn how to handle it. And, you know, as time goes on, you hope that you get a better understanding of that, and you benefit from it, you know?
Well, it is so much different here in the United States. And you mentioned the statistics and the win percentages, which I know a lot of owners will look at win percentages. And if you have a low win percentage, they're not going to send you a horse. So it's important to have the high win percentages, but you're also looking out for the other owners and doing what's right for the horse. It has to be a very difficult balancing act, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, that's the thing. I mean, you know, and sometimes the horses will run, you know, they'll run really well, but they don't win. But everybody looks at your win percentage. You know, people commented to me in my first year, oh, why should we send you a horse? Your win percentage is not that high. I'm like, no, but you know, you do what you have, especially people with a small amount of runners. You know, if you're running 50, 60 horses, the win percentage or the stats aren't as important or you know, they're not something you look into as much as somebody that's going to run 500 or 600 horses every year, you know. Because with a small number of horses, you're obviously going to have less opportunities to win races. And you know, that's the way it works. But last year they were better. This year we've been running, my horses have been running great down in Florida this year. But, you know, I've had a bunch of seconds, thirds, fourths. But you're running against the best trainers in the country. You're running against all the guys from New York, all the guys from Florida, everybody from Kentucky. I mean, it's, Gulfstream is super tough.
Yeah, I'll give you an example, Brendan. Looking at your statistics here on Equibase, last year you had 54 starters. You won 10 races, 8 seconds and 5 thirds. That's pretty darn good from 54 starters. This year, 19 starters thus far, sitting here in early April, 5 seconds, 3 thirds. No winners yet, but still on the board in 8 of 19. All of a sudden, you throw in 2 or 3 wins in a row, and those numbers are looking really strong.
Exactly, and you know, I've had a bunch of horses down here as well, Michael. You know, I think 3 of them seconds were, you know, necks or heads or something like that. So, you know, if you have a little more luck, they win. But you're getting beat by the best horses in the country. So you'd hope when things thin out as the year goes on, you go back up to Kentucky or that. You know, you've got so much. The thing about the winter here too, I think. You know, you're in Florida, you've basically just got Florida. You're in, you're in New York, you've basically got Aqueduct. You know, we go up to Kentucky for the spring and you've got the different tracks, Keeneland, Churchill, you've Ellis Park, you've Kentucky Downs now as well. You know, you've just got, you know, Arlington, you've just got so much more access to different tracks. And I think then you get a bit more of a spread, and you know, the horses have been running well. I mean, you can't ask for more than that. So you'd hope once we get up north this year that, you know, we'll hit the ground running. This time last year was the same. You know, I wasn't flying this time last year. And then I think just before I left here and the first 3 weeks in Kentucky, I had 7 winners.
Yeah,
you know, so.
Yeah. Brendan, only about a minute or so left here. Believe it or not, this has really flown by. We could spend another half hour, but I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. You said that as a kid growing up, you were very much into boxing, and you were a boxer.
Yeah.
You know, Ron Moquette's a boxer, too, so maybe we can get a little charity match together.
I don't know about that.
Can you take him?
I reckon. I don't know. He might be a little higher on the handicap than me.
Well, are you still boxing now?
No, God, no. I love sports. I love soccer, golf. I actually still do a bit of running when I get time, But no more boxing. I gave it up when I was, oh God, I guess it was 19, 20. But we did it at, so I did it at national level, so it was a pretty good level, and it was great. It was great when I was a kid. It was great sport to learn, and that, all that kind of thing is great for kids. I think, you know, it teaches you discipline, and you know, teaches you how to lose, which you got to get used to in this game, Michael. You know?
Yeah, isn't that the truth? Brendan Walsh here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Brendan, can't thank you enough for taking the time. Always a delight to catch up with you. All the best moving forward, and I'll look forward to seeing you here at Keeneland.
Thanks for having me on, Michael, and we'll see you soon.
All right, and Brendan Walsh, like all of our guests who appear on the program, receives a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get that out to Brendan here shortly. Boy, what a show. Steve Margolis in the first half, Brendan Walsh in the second half of the program. If you missed any portion of the show, a podcast available on our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen at your leisure and listen to all of our trainer talk shows on our website and, of course, on iTunes. Been a lot of fun. We're back next week with Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Mark it on your calendar. Do not miss it. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next week here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.